Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. You're tuned in for the final episode of Carol Bly's Shelter Half, a novel published by Holy Cow Press of Duluth.
Chapter 15 continues. Walt sat down. George nodded to Marty Hanks, Jr. The Boy Scout went down the two steps and down the aisle. There was a silence, during which George also came down and stood before them in silence. Now the scout was escorting a man forward, and George smiled. When they got near, George reached out his hand and shook hands with Dieter Stoltz. With the other hand, he showed him to the right side armchair that had been kept for him. If the German-American farmer was amazed, he didn't show it. Not everyone knew Dieter Stoltz, but everybody had heard of him. Well, people thought, and their hearts warmed because everyone on the podium was smiling. Besides, it was over a half century since this fellow had served in Wehrmacht. The mayor said it was his great pleasure to introduce to them Brigadier General Frank Goretter, United States Army, retired. The officer rose and stood in front of them. He said, "I am very happy to be here among you. Where is Bridget Garris?" He made Bridget stand. "I would never have known to come to St. Fursey if it weren't for her. Then I really never would have had the right people to tell my story to. That's because the citizens of St. Fursey are the right people. I'm going to tell you one particular part of my life as a soldier during World War II. There are others here tonight who served in that war. I want to greet them as one old soldier to another." And here he looked down at the front row of three old men in their armchairs and smiled at them, face by face. Then he looked up at the whole audience again. "I want to tell you my story because it has something to say, not just to soldiers, but to all of us." He had been born a second-generation German-American in a family that still spoke German. His draft board of late 1943, learning that this latest 1A recruit spoke fluent German, immediately recommended him for military intelligence. "Good thing," he said with a laugh, looking all over the room, gathering everyone into his story as if it were a joke. They grinned back at him. "A very good thing. I was a terrible shot. I expect every one of you men in this room is a better shot than I was." He trained for intelligence. He was sent to Europe, where his first experience in combat was to be taken prisoner. No heroism there. He explained the difficulties of the Ardennes forest in early spring of 1945. Snowfall, cold, loss of air support, encirclement by German units. One night, he got lost. Here and there, dead American soldiers lay in the snow. Snow had drifted against some of them. He himself was not wounded, but he had turned his ankle on a smashed-up jumble of snow-covered tank tread. He was 19. "Perhaps some of you," the old man said with a genial look, "were brave at 19. I happened not to be, in addition to the fact that I wasn't even a good shot." He had thought, "I can walk if I put my mind to it." He couldn't. He sat down, his wool coat long since sopped through with snow. He tried to plan. He had his sector map, but was so disoriented that he might have been crawling around in an area off the map. A wrecked Sherman stood nearby. A wrecked half-track lay on its side with a hole through its driver's door. Night was coming. Then he heard someone moving cautiously. His heart leapt. If only it were an American, even an American from some other outfit. It might not be, however, so he had better play dead in case the person creeping around was a German. So he lowered his upper body and half hid his face with one hand. He had taken his glove off, but didn't dare reach for it, lest it make a sound. "Please be a GI," he breathed. His fingers began to ache with cold. Between his fingers, he opened his upper eye a crack. A German sergeant was creeping about from one dead American soldier to another, getting closer. He was collecting something, probably food or both food and ammunition. Some German troops had been regularly short of ammunition. They counted on picking up Garand rifles and the bullets to go with them. This fellow was now clearly approaching. "Don't get out your knife," he prayed silently. "Don't get out your knife. Look, I'm dead. Anyone can see I'm dead." He told himself to leave his eyes open because it is the living who have shut eyes. The dead's eyes are open. The German approached, now crawling to get under the bent long rifle of the nearest tank. He was coming. "Don't move your pupils at all," Frank said to himself. The German seemed to be collecting K rations. Frank didn't have any. The German glanced right into Frank's eyes between the fingers. He paused. Then he came still closer and now brushed Frank's hand away from his face. Frank's fingers felt cold even to himself, but he was afraid they were not cold like dead man's hands. The German bolted upright and leveled into Frank's face an American pistol, a 38 of the kind officers sometimes wore. "No, don't kill me," Frank thought. He decided to beg. After all, he spoke German, so he could beg. Now the old man paused to smile at his St. Fursey audience. He said, "The better side of valor is begging. Don't let them tell you different." Everyone laughed gratefully. They still felt the dread of his story, but now he had included them, so they felt comradely. Some of them wondered if they themselves would have begged. The German was Frank's age, perhaps a year older, not more. Frank said in German, "Please." He asked Frank what was loss with him. Frank felt lucky it was only an ankle. If he had been hopelessly wounded, nearly dying, the German sergeant would likely have killed him. As it was, he held that revolver on him and asked him to show him his ankle. It was badly swollen. He said, "Ach," the way Germans do. The brigadier general looked at one of the program committee sitting just below the podium, a gigantic fat fellow he had met at his host's house. He shouted down to him, "You guys still say ach, I bet?" Walt Steinsider went rosy in his huge face. "Yeah, we say ach, and worse," he cried. The brigadier general let out laughter. The brigadier general let the laughter rove around the room and then picked up his story. The German sergeant told him to stay there. Frank said, "I am not going anywhere." The German actually gave him the ghost of a smile. "No, I don't suppose you are." He went off and came back with three or four little boys. They had a blanket which he made them turn into a rough seat. They got Frank onto it. They carried him off, making hard work of it. They were just kids, but suited up in Wehrmacht privates. One of them even had a Waffen-SS insignia. The brigadier general explained to his St. Fursey audience that various units in the West had Waffen-SS personnel attached to them to keep up morale. To keep up morale, one learned, was to prevent squads and platoons or whole patrol groupen from finding armies and surrendering to them. They were taking him off to woods he hadn't explored. They came across fewer dumps of equipment and fewer bodies scattered about. They seemed familiar with the terrain because, although it was getting very dark, they didn't barge into things like tank treads the way he'd done. At last they came to a small clearance. There were a few tents set up. They were like our shelter halves, but in quarters. Now he saw a few other soldiers. Kids had a low fire going. The sergeant told them to heat up what he'd brought them. He was like an old fox bringing back dinner for the kits. It looked like the mix of stuff that Frank had gotten his hands on before, when lost. Now that enemy patrol, if that's what they were, would be eating together for days. 5-in-1s, which were like K-rations, but intended for 5 men to heat and eat together. Some K-rations, some C-rations. The old soldier now told the audience he would make a 3 weeks. Story short, those Germans kept him alive. They splinted his ankle for him and fed him as well as themselves. He and their leader, the sergeant, talked. The men sat around in cheerful circles at night, drinking from a healthy supply of brandy they had unearthed. They shot small deer and fried chunks of the meat in rendered K-ration bacon. The bacon itself they ate for a kind of rough canopy while they waited for dinner. There were only 8 of them, and except for their sergeant, were all 14 years old. What was left of their uniforms seemed to fit, but the helmets were outsized, made for men. The boys wound woolen sock strips inside their head supports. Now and again, they shared what they had left of German rations with him, a fairly tasty mix of cooked rice and sausage meat. Their mission, he began to realize as they kept him with him, was to be taken prisoner. They regarded him, the sergeant explained, as the American who could best lead them back to American forces. That was the sergeant's tactful way of saying that when they found U.S. troops in great enough numbers to surrender to, they would keep him, in his uniform, out in front of them as they came in. Their practical danger was that Americans were much less likely to take prisoners in fewer numbers than 40 or 50. The German sergeant kept them going partly on humor, partly on their depending on him to think for them. The sergeant had a kind of mental alacrity which is always interesting yet in itself. Frank would have liked to talk more with that German. The fellow clearly was a civilized kind of person, clearly meant to get all of his men and Frank as well alive into Allied hands. Frank found that he trusted him completely. There was a problem, however. Whenever he and the German sat smoking wet cigarettes to troop that they found in some dead soldier's cache of souvenirs, the SS boy would inch himself up near them. That boy had an unpleasant look of intent in his eye. Frank's intelligence training had taught him that most of these very young Waffen-SS boys had been indoctrinated later and more severely than the other boys. It was possible that this boy would not want to surrender. There was an unspoken skirmishing of wills between the boy and the sergeant. Clearly, the SS boy wanted to kill Americans. He kept offering to serve guard duty over Frank so that the sergeant could sleep longer. Frank's heart would pound at the very thought. They all urinated more or less right anywhere they were, merely facing outward by way of civility. They moved off several yards, however, in order to defecate in a place already assigned. Frank knew that if that boy were his guard when he went to the Schleißengrund, he would kill him for attempting to escape. Fortunately, the sergeant always gave prisoner guard duty to one of the others. At night, they heard a good deal of firing of carbines, which suggested that Americans were popping away at those same forest small deer that they hunted. On nights when they couldn't hear any firing of either carbines or ordinary M1s, they would make a nearly decent-sized fire as opposed to the tiny fires they could shade with a shelter vertel. On those nights, the sergeant would let the boys feed up, drink up, and then he'd give them lectures. He kept their spirits up. Once he tried to make Frank give them English lessons, but the SS boy lost his mind. He shouted that they would have no use for English when the war was over. The sergeant covered his back. Of course, the sergeant said mildly, so they had no English lessons. The brigadier general said, I remember one of these evenings. I especially admired him for. He had gone off by himself all afternoon, prowling about, leaving me guarded by three of the others. The remaining boys were told to make a good dinner as they could. We will be celebrating, he said. What were we celebrating, I asked, since no one else asked. Today is the birthday of Paul Joseph Goebbels, he said, looking me squarely in the eye. When he returned, we all ate a reheated leg of deer from the day before, the last of their rice and sausage casserole, and some fried scrambled egg sandwiches from some very good sea rations that had been better protected than the rest of our scavenged food, because it had lain under a tipped-over field kitchen. We had a real politic lesson. Why were the Amis able to make landings on Fortress Europe at all, the sergeant would ask. Why are they able to push us back into Germany? The SS boy answered first, and no one interrupted him. They will not push us back into Germany, he said in his stout tone. Everything he said as announcement to prisoners in a Stalag. They were all patient with him. Of course not, the sergeant said. Ganz richtig, Jürgen. Anyone else? They have industry and money, someone said. If we had those aircraft and weapons that they have, they wouldn't be here. Right, said the German sergeant amiably. But another point which is nearly a military secret of the United States. The United States, he explained, had its northern boundary exactly on the 49th parallel of north latitude. Now this boundary was not guarded. Anybody could visit the Dominion of Canada whenever they wanted. Canadians could visit the United States. Now, why was this useful to the Americans? No one had the least idea. All I myself remembered was that the Rush-Bagot Treaty of 1818 or 1828, one or the other, stressed an unpolitical border, except that each nation was allowed two police boats on the Great Lakes. It is this, the sergeant told his little troop. That open border let Americans go to the north of Ontario and Manitoba, which he explained, which were provinces north of Minnesota, specially to find polar bears each season when they migrated. Polar bear flesh was all right, but it was not strategic food for soldiers. What was strategic food, he said, speaking with serious emphasis, for the reason that it gave so much energy, was polar bear stool. The boys tentatively smiled, but when the sergeant's severe glance went around their fire-lighted faces, their smiles disappeared. They weren't 100% sure of what it all meant. At last he said, I have been lucky. I have found some for you. I looked all over this afternoon, and I found some. He unstrapped his bread bag. In it were not two or three, but about 9 or 10 of what I recognized as USAD rations. Chocolate candy bars, the delight of soldiers throughout the ages. The trouble with these, the D-ration version, was they were very frankly, the printing on the packaging said as much, manufactured in Kansas City, Missouri. In 1933, they were plenty stale before some Kania Army supplier got the contract to sell them. Each candy bar was completely coated white with age. Now, the sergeant said, everyone gets one, after which we'll cut up the others for seconds. But I want everyone to eat one, because it will give you the energy to repel these invaders who want to take the fatherland. A wonder bar energy, polar bear scat, you must eat. He had the knife out. He looked at their half-doubting, half-horrified faces. Have courage, he said. You're in luck. Someone in Kansas City, Missouri, it says so on the packaging, put chocolate flavor into them. It makes them much, much more palatable. If the Amis who had these were alive and knew you were eating them, they would be yellow with envy. I, for one, am glad, he said as though confiding something in the way that complacent upper-grade non-commissioned officers sometimes decide to be pals with privates. I am partial to a sweet after-dinner. He passed them around and saw that each man bit into his candy bar, each face in turn filled with delight. It was chocolate. There's nothing like chocolate. They knew that much. This was our last meal together, as it happened, the birthday of Goebbels. The next day, we heard firing closer. The sergeant took his little patrol along a faint animal path in the woods, going on a diagonal toward the sound. He kept me beside him. He kept the SS boy in the rear. I believe he had told that boy to be sure no one made a dash to escape to the American lines through the woods. Then he and I, 12 meters ahead of the others, saw a declivity in front of us, and there we found what surpassed our best hopes. Parked on a kind of logging trail, below us stood a jeep. In it sat one enlisted driver and 3 officers. I looked at the sergeant, and he looked at me. I will never forget that moment. We were nearly friends by then. Still, war is war, and each of us had to keep reassuring the other that we intended no treachery. I grinned at him and told him that we were in luck. Those were officers off having a private little drinking party. The 3 of them seemed to be sharing a bottle with their driver. The only weapons we could see were light carbines jammed into those vertical holders. I couldn't be sure about pistols because I couldn't see their right hips. My sergeant looked at me as if to say, now that we have come this far, I am going to shove you in front of me with my weapon, he said. You stay behind. I will go talk to them. That was the first I knew he spoke English. I should have guessed he might. Someday he would matriculate as a student. I told him, I'd better go with him. What if those fellows were drunk? If they saw one felled weevil alone, even approaching very slowly with his hands up, they might decide to be heroes and shoot him. In the weeks before I was captured, I had seen Germans sneaking along hedgerows to join one another, the idea being to make up a large enough group so that, when they surrendered, the Americans they approached would feel obliged to take prisoners. I told him we'd slide down onto that road together, but I would talk loud to them in English all the time we approached the jeep. He turned around and told his men to lie down and not show themselves. Then, laying down his own MP-40, he pulled out a white cloth, which he had kept hidden from all of us so far. He held it above his head, We skidded down the little incline together. The Americans were startled. I kept shouting at them. He did too. No, no, he kept saying in an English accent he'd been taught. Do not stretch for your weapons. My men have you covered on both sides. He told them in quaint, rather elegant English that he had 8 and 40 men on the other side aimed at the jeep right now, and on our side he had 30. He told them to sit still. He would explain his plan. He said, I do not want war. Here is what we want. I said, first of all, he said, that smell is tobacco. We want cigarettes. We want to take just a few back to our men. I had been staying half in front of him just to make sure. I let him do the talking. My war was over now, I thought. He was managing fine. The corporal in the driver's seat handed over a package with most of the 20 cigarettes in it. Field matches, too. The German read the yellow and gold. Lucky Strike, he said, then corrected himself. Lucky Strike. Thank you. Then he explained he would return to his men and instruct them to come out at 3-meter intervals, hands upward and without their weapons. I am going to bring out my men on either side of the road, starting against over your jeep. Then they will move forward. You already face to the American line, so when all my men are here, you will escort us, and we are surrendered to you. Is all understood? One of the officers nodded and said to me, tell him okay. I climbed back up off the road and into the woods with him. He made the boys crawl up close. They looked very worried. He calmed them. He said, this is a type called a Lucky Strike cigarette. He explained what he wanted them to do when he signaled. I ambled along back the path we had come on. The German boys were too excited to light their cigarettes. They each took one from the pack and put it in his pocket. Now he spoke very quietly so they wouldn't get twitchy. I realized the moment he started talking that he had rehearsed this speech over and over, possibly for weeks. He said, now you lay down your weapons. Your duties to the Führer are now over, and my duty to your mothers has just begun. I am going to deliver you, all of you, alive to your mothers. You are going to grow up and go to university and marry and be fathers of children. Everybody ready? Obey me then this last time. I watched, fascinated, as one by one they laid down their pathetic weapons, 3 M40s with no bullets, 2 picked-up M1s. The poor kids had been told they'd be shot if they laid down their weapons. It was hard for them now, but they trusted their sergeant. They obeyed him. Or what? He shouted, and they stood up. Every 3 meters, he told them. They went slowly out of the woods, slid down the embankment, and lined up alongside the road, with curious glances at the Americans in the jeep. I watched for a half second or so, and then I dropped back behind a tree. Might be hours before we could relieve ourselves in a prison camp. They were moving so slowly I would catch up without trouble. After a few minutes, the Americans were shouting at me, so I shouted back and got out of those woods for the last time. The German sergeant and his men were standing, hands up along the road as he had promised. The first lieutenant in the back seat said, okay, where are all the others? The German sergeant said, this is all I have. They are 14 years old. No, one is 15. The others are 14. Then he added, please. Okay, the lieutenant said. He turned to the driver. Home, James. The little cavalcade started off. The American driver said to me, you want to ride? Nah, I told him, but they all want to put their hands down and smoke their cigarettes. It all went very well. As soon as we got to the nearest Americans, the sergeant and I were questioned. He and his men were put into a huge field with a lot of other German troops. It was a very smelly place because it was 3/4 surrounded by a 10-foot latrine ditch. I was told how to reach my unit after they had heard my story of being a prisoner. I shook hands with my German sergeant. The brigadier general broke off his story. Well, that was over half a century ago, he said. The entire audience hung silent. The brigadier general said, you know, that German sergeant did something unusual for a human being. He made up his mind on his own that the Führer was wrong in consigning those young boys to be killed in hopeless battle. So he saved them. He simply made the decision to save children. How many people can think for themselves and do a merciful, risky act which their own government might label treason? Few. The room was dead still. Then the retired general gave everyone a smile. That man who made up his own mind is here tonight. I feel honored. Most of you know him, but some of you may not. So let me introduce him. I will ask him to join me up here. His name is Karl Dieter Stoltz, sergeant in the 19th German Infantry, 1944 to 1945. Slowly, the old strawberry farmer went up the steps to shake hands with the general. People cried, as people do. At last, everyone was left but Bridget Garris, who had the keys, and Peter Tenebrae. Two old soldiers still stood talking in the glass doorway of the library office. Peter half wanted to remind them that Dieter Stoltz could join them for a nightcap at his house, yet he didn't like to interrupt. They had moved over into speaking German. Peter supposed they were getting down to fine points. He hung back and pretended to confer with Bridget about closing up. Only later did he find out what they were talking about. Dieter bowed out of Peter's offer of a nightcap. Back at Peter's house, the general repeated for him the conversation he and Dieter Stoltz had carried on in the library doorway. "Why did you take so long coming down out of the woods?" Dieter had said. "I had almost given up on you. I couldn't imagine what you were up to." "I was hiding behind a tree," laughed the general. "I didn't want my drunk countrymen to change their minds and decide to shoot you down as you came out of the woods. So I was no hero. I hid." Dieter laughed. He paused. Then he said, "But you know, one of my men never came out. When I asked the others, they didn't know. Some thought he must have gone ahead. Others thought he was lagging. I myself wondered if he was such a patriotic little SS fellow that he would refuse to surrender." "Oh, that," the general said. "From behind my tree, I watched those kids wait their distance and then go out, hands over their heads. Jürgen was last. He waited his 3 meters, too. He stood up, but then stooped down. I thought he had dropped his cigarettes he'd passed out, but no. Then I thought he was doing something we all did, picking up souvenirs. What he had his hands on was the last kid's little machine pistol. Then he raised it. I was a little slow on the pickup. I think a whole second passed before I realized that he was going to mow all of us down from behind. And then, who knows if he had still had enough ammo, perhaps get the Americans in their jeep. Maybe he had dreamed of a Ritter first class if they were still being awarded." A silence fell on the two men. "So?" Dieter finally asked, a little coldly. "So I crept up on him from behind. I wasn't sorry I had no weapon. I probably would have missed, and in any case, those Americans would have heard the shot and reacted. Besides, what they taught me in intelligence was bare hands work. Jürgen was a determined little patriot. He would have killed as many of us as he could." Natalie and Peter had lighted the fire, and Natalie had given them each a brandy. It should have been extraordinarily pleasant. Extraordinarily, Peter thought. Not just a cordial ending to an evening carried off so well. An extraordinarily successful occasion. What was wrong with him, Peter thought. He slightly tipped and turned his globe with its sea of drink. In these last few days, he had had to fake his usual high spirits. That is, usually, when he found himself in a room with people he loved, or even just expected to love, when he knew them better, his mind would fly forwards toward them, full of gaiety. He would let his own gaiety bear everyone along, just looking into their faces. Peter could recall people's interests and hobbies, the recent events of their lives, whatever they had once mentioned to him, and might like to talk about some more. His own happiness would gather them up and chew people breezily into their stories. Now, however, he got the idea that his own life as a simple man was over. The American general story was not just some anecdote. It would always lie underneath whatever other conversations Peter heard from now on. Of course, Peter would go on rejoicing that his daughter was starting a happy life. Of course, of course. From now on, though, he would always know that when you learned any bad news, you had to make yourself believe that bad news fast, very fast, and act as if it were true, if you really meant to give shelter or safety to anyone, even to yourself. The End.